Yeah, that's fine. These schools are always stressful.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Ford Staff. Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, this is Ford Staff. Can you hear me on the call?
Yes. Yeah, I can hear you.
Thank you. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay, it is 2:34. We'll call the meeting to order. Sherry, could you give us a roll call, please?
Yes. Hero.
Here.
I want to say Ali, but it's Bag Eye.
Here.
Beanstalk. Blazik.
Here.
Brady.
Here.
Brownstein.
Here.
Christensen.
Thank you.
Oh,
German, absent. Laut.
Here.
Snell.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. We're going to skip the call to the public while Christina is working on some computer issues. And so we'll just dive right into the agenda item number 3, notice of proposed rulemaking. One of the topics that's monopolized a lot of our time has been the permitting process. Mayor.
Yeah, that's fine. These schools are always stressful.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Ford Staff. Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, this is Ford Staff. Can you hear me on the call?
Yes. Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay, it is 2:34. We'll call the meeting to order. Sherry, could you give us a roll call, please?
Yes. Hero.
Here.
I want to say Ali, but it's Bag Eye.
Here.
Beanstalk. Blazik.
Here.
Brady.
Here.
Brownstein.
Here.
Christensen.
Thank you.
Always one.
German, absent. Laut.
Here.
Snell.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. We're going to skip the call to the public while Christina is working on some computer issues. And so we'll just dive right into the agenda item number 3, notice of proposed rulemaking. One of the topics that's monopolized a lot of our time has been the permitting process. Mayor, can you just kind of weigh in on what was talked about last few meetings with regards to the 1304 permit?
Yes. So, good afternoon. My name is Mary Williams from the Attorney General's Office. I'm covering for Seth Hargrave. So my limited understanding, and Dr. Hero corrects me if I'm wrong, and I just reviewed the draft of the rules. So my understanding is that there might be a move to basically bring in anesthesiologists and CRNAs under the dental board jurisdiction, that there would be some regulation by the dental board, which can't be done through a rule, can't be done through any kind of a memorandum of understanding or intergovernmental agency agreement or anything. It could only be done through a statutory change and through what's called the sunrise process. So anytime a regulatory board wants to increase its regulation, there's a sunrise process that they have to go through. And it's a very detailed statutory process that's gone through the legislature. So even if the dental board just wanted to increase its regulation, I think when they did it through for mobile dentistry, there was a sunrise process. So something when you're reaching out to bring in another profession into an agency's regulation, that wouldn't be allowed.
Thank you for being here. Alan Gunn, CRNA. I've been through a couple sunrise processes myself. My understanding of a sunrise process is that it is for an increased scope of practice.
Either increased scope of practice or new regulation. So if there's a new board, like I think when the massage board probably came into existence, they would have to go through the sunrise process to regulate.
I guess I'm not understanding why it's new.
Well, it's because the dental board, the CRNAs, you're regulated by the nursing board.
Of course, right.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so I more question then, you know, what if we had, you know, and maybe it would require legislation, but I'm wondering if it would require a sunrise process. But,
and I'm not, I'm kind of was thinking through that.
Yeah.
And I'm not prepared to answer any of that today.
Okay.
So I just was asked to kind of opine on, it was mentioned that, you know, maybe a MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, was being discussed. And I think you've been told this before. I don't think I'm telling you.
Yeah, no.
Anybody anything new? I'm not here to opine on any kind of policy issues or pros or cons or anything. That's not my lane.
Okay. Well, one thought that I had just to kind of discuss the committee, because I have been through a couple of sunrise processes, but basically mm-hmm. challenging is when you have people within the same community that disagree, right? So if we came together and created a bill that we think could accomplish this, and in my mind, something that could accomplish it would be some sort of multidisciplinary committee that has representation from the medical board, the dental board, and the nursing board. If we presented that to the legislator as a unified medical, dental, and nursing community, that would just, it would sail through legislation. I mean, that would be, so maybe as we're hearing from Ms. Williams that this is not going to be able to get done here, I don't think that it means that the work of this committee, or at least the people on this committee, can accomplish something, but maybe it means that coming together with legislation to create that sort of multidisciplinary committee that would maybe be underneath all three boards to kind of manage this.
And that might be something you want to discuss at a later meeting. I don't think that's on this agenda. No, and my advice was based on my review of your draft rule. And I don't know, whatever one I was done. Whatever one is in your packet for today. So if there's other ways to go about it, that's something that's, you know, beyond me right now. I'm not here to offer any alternatives. I just wanted to point that out.
Appreciate it, Mary. And maybe that's something we can get on a future agenda to kind of talk through that portion of it. But calculating.
Well, I guess I was just hoping for clarification. And again, maybe we can't talk about it because it's not on the agenda. I don't know. But what's the difference in what the dental board is currently doing, which is we are regulating what CRNAs and what NDAs come into the dental office versus what we're proposing in the legislative recommendations for statute changes, which is not much different. I don't believe there's any difference. But when you say jurisdiction, I think that's such a broad word, like we're going to take your license or what have you. That's not what we're looking to do. We're looking to say a CRNA or an NDA, we're giving you a permit to practice in the dental office, which currently they have to do anyway.
So I don't think
they hold the permit, though, right?
Yeah,
the
1304 permitting process is issued to the dentist. And it doesn't matter what MD, or if it's an MD or CRNA, or which specific MD or CRNA they're working with, the board doesn't specify that. It's just that dentist has obtained the permit and can now work with the physician and the officer.
And I think if there's conduct on the part of the anesthesiologist or the nurse, you know, is that issue, then that gets referred, I would imagine, to the medical board or the nursing board. Mm-hmm. The dental board doesn't, obviously can't discipline a CRNA or a doctor.
If, clarification, so if the permit is given to the CRNA or the MD, then by rule or whatever, the dental board technically has jurisdiction. What it's saying is the dental board could come in and say, hey, MD anesthesiologist, you were permitted by us, and we can take action against
it. If that were to happen down the road.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not done through.
Right.
Hi, this is Jason Brady. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. I think from the dental board's perspective, the concern is there are dentists that may not have the same equivalent educational qualifications, but they're able to obtain a permit to bring on a CRNA or an MD anesthesiologist to do anesthesia that are very well qualified. There's no question about that, to perform those services. Just like a surgeon is not an anesthesiologist to have those services in their offices. And the conundrum becomes that when something, an event does happen in a dental board, the only thing the dental board has jurisdiction to do is something on the dentist themselves. And so that same, even if it's a completely anesthesia issue, can happen in none the wiser office B the very next day. And I think that's where a lot of states have said, well, the only way that you can, because we can't permit non-dentists, the only way to mitigate that situation is that they allow the dentist to only perform anesthesia services to bring people in that aren't permitted, that are to the level of permit that they hold themselves. So meaning an oral surgeon or a dentist anesthesiologist could bring on an MD anesthesiologist or CRNA to do general anesthesia. Or a general practitioner may have a moderate sedation permit. They could bring on the same non-permitted dentist, but they can only practice to the level of moderate sedation. California had what I thought was a solution to that, to say that there's language in there saying that, hey, we're not going to have sanctions or disciplinary action on your license. We don't want that control. The only thing that we want to do is that you have a permit to be able to practice inside a dental office because we're the credentialing body for dentistry, which is different than medical, because medical has their credentialing body through either like the Joint Commission or a third party accreditation system or the hospital. And so you have like these different languages trying to talk to each other. And so I felt that California was somehow able to accomplish this because they are able to give permits to physicians or to non-permitted anesthesia providers. And I think that's where we are all in alignment with each other, because we all support the idea of, okay, we want to be able to stop a situation, at least temporarily, or try to figure out what that is, and then have their respective boards do any disciplinary action.
And I'm not familiar with California. I'm not arguing with the policy,
but for
you all to figure out the policy. I don't have an opinion on that. But I'm just, you know, it's just, this isn't the way to go about it. There may be a way to go about it.
And this is Brady. I'm just asking, are you saying that if we have a unified voice and we feel that all boards are on this agreement, that the only process would be through this sunset process, is through that change?
It's sunrise, and I'm not 100% sure on that, but it would need to be through statute.
Through statute, okay.
So, Mary, how should we look at trying to agendize this portion of the conversation so that we can have some better guidance on, if it is a statutory change, how we could potentially go about doing that?
It would just need a, you know, recommendation for future legislation, maybe, or
okay,
something, you know, we can work with staff to come up with an agenda item.
And that would potentially give staff more of an opportunity to look into the specific process to give the committee
sure
some guidance on it. that might be the next best step, because I think the committee has spent a lot of time on this topic in particular, and I hate to belabor that more until we know exactly what we can and can't do. And I think the committee is in agreement that this philosophically would be a good approach. If there's a way to accomplish it, you know, that would be worth pursuing. So I'm kind of speaking for the committee, but if anyone wants to jump in.
I mean, thank you for being here and bringing this up. I mean, you probably sense our frustration because, like, the rules that you're looking at were approved last September. The CRNA community ran legislation.
So real quick, it's not been approved.
Approved by this committee, right? That's why it's in
Well, not really. It's still all a debate. Everything is still debated.
Okay.
So I just wanted, because I heard that before from a lobbyist, and I was like, no, not necessarily. They're still working through some details, so not completely. There might be certain parts of it that have been reviewed and approved by this committee, but not in its entirety.
Fine. There are minutes from the September meeting that say motion to approve.
But not this document in its entirety.
No, not the document in its entirety.
That's why I mean.
The rules here that is an older version, but essentially the same idea, right? But I mean, it's very frustrating to me because when we ran legislation last year, we could have all come together and gotten this done. And now we're sitting here all beating our heads because we've all spent a great deal of time trying to come together for something that's going to work. And now we're just going to go back to the legislature anyways. That's what I just mentioned, us all doing together. That's what we have to do. That's what legal counsel just told us. So it's deeply frustrating that's now where we have to go back to fix any of this, right?
Well, I mean, I think, this is Christensen, I think the legislation was proposed initially, we didn't know about. That came from the CRNA group that none of us were aware of until it was put out there. So when you kind of say that we're coming together then.
No, we've come together since. Well, we could have come together then.
Well, I mean, that wasn't really anything we even knew about since on the table. You didn't tell us that was going on. That kind of surprised all of us.
It came on pretty suddenly, the whole process.
So saying everybody coming together, that was a one-sided motion, and by your CRNAs, and we kind of all had to figure out what was going on, what the end game was. So I'm just saying that I don't think that was really accurate. I think
you're misunderstanding what I was saying. I was saying we could have come together then and figured it out. But since that happened, we have been coming together. We have a subcommittee that's been discussing this in great detail to try and get to a good place.
This also, these are only recommendations. This is Christensen again. This is the only recommendations that are going to put before the dental board. So technically, I mean, it can be something if you made motion here, but it has to go to the dental board actually to approve.
Of course.
To do anything further this time.
Of course.
So, you know, I mean, I think, again, it's probably worth tabling this portion of it, as frustrating as that is, until we get better clarity on if we wanted to pursue a statutory change, what that would entail. Is it, can we do it based off of the conversation we're having today? But until we know more, I think we're going to just kind of talk in circles until we get a better answer.
This is Blazek. I'll have to support what Ali said. We have lobbyists that we work with quite a bit, and we presented almost the exact same thing that Mrs. Williams suggested, that if the organization, the group comes together and you have the other governing body, the nursing board and the medical board coming together, and we all kind of agreed on it, the legislature usually gives it a pass. And so I don't think that we're that far off.
Yeah.
So I would support your idea to agendize the item and let's rock and roll.
Yeah.
Good. Great. This is great. I concur.
Okay. All right. All right. Let's move on next to the,
Are we turning these heat down a little bit in here, or is it just me?
It's set at 85. Is that too hot? I'm just kidding. It's 75. I'll write to the building management. Hopefully they can turn it down.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Tomorrow.
I think the next topic would probably be the pediatric education that we want to work through. And before we even get into that, you know, just to kind of recap, I think the focus right now for the committee should be getting through all the rules so that the committee can start to make a recommendation to the board. My sense is that most of the rules the committee is going to be in agreement on with the edits that I know several members have worked on. Yes, the pediatric vaccination permitting process, we want to get some answers to so that we can start to try to wrap things up. But let's talk through the pediatric designation. I know some committee members spoke recently about that. Maybe we get a recap.
Should be. I'm not sure that that's the word.
This is loud. I can give a recap.
Great. Thank you.
For your recommendation, we have like a pediatric subcommittee.
Right.
Been touching base with this. We met a couple of times, and then we had the representatives from Mississippi. Dr. Brady had invited them to join us for a telephone conference, I believe it was August 5th, to share their experience with doing it, implementing it, had a copy of their, I believe it was their statutes to look at, to work with. And when we met on the 5th, they discussed the pros and the cons, the challenges that they faced with the different specialties of that nature. So we talked and linked with them. They gave us some ideas. Dr. Germain kind of put together their document with where it was more applicable to Arizona. And then he sent that to the committee, and then we further edited it. So we just we took care of the different permits, the 1301, 1302, 1303. We did not touch the 1304. We just didn't know. And then there's a section at the bottom, which is like number of providers per permit, depending on anesthesia, moderate sedation, minimal sedation. So we did not delve into that. Dr. Germain put that all together based on their thing. So we just touched base regarding the pediatric enforcement. Did you want me to go through the? I think I sent this to everybody. Did you want me to go through that, or do we just want to go in each section and talk about it?
I think just talking about it.
Okay. So I guess I open that up to the floor. Anybody had any suggestions?
Yeah, I have a couple of things. Well, one of the things that kind of I thought was glaring, or I think I would say difficult to understand, was under the 1302 permit, when you either have to graduate from an accredited residency, item number one, or item number two, you wrote, it's written, 60 hours of didactic instruction, including physical management, blah, 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 blah. Then in subsection item number one, under item number two, you write down a minimum of 22 hours of didactic instruction on pediatric sedation, including. So are we saying it's 60 hours total and 22 of them have to be pediatric specific? And why that's even more confusing is in the strike, the previous regulation that's been struck out, it says 60 only. So can you clarify? Is it 60 total, 22 specific, pediatric, or what's the
story? I've got to guess that was just an amalgamation of the two documents. Kind of Arizona in that I think with probably in retrospect, and I kind of did this with the 1303, I think we're looking more at 60 hours for people that have not completed residency.
So 60 hours total?
Right.
Okay.
In pediatric.
So I think if we clean this up, that would make it a lot more.
So we can delete the starts at minimum of 22 hours. We can just go with the straight 60, and I think that's what was going on.
Because that's kind of traditionally what it's been, right? If you don't come from a program, you've got to get postgraduate training.
And that is what other states have done for pediatrics.
Okay, so you get rid of the 22. And then the other area that was a bit confusing was in one section we said, I think the original thing was 20 moderate sedation cases. And then with the changes, you're saying 10 live patient, but then 20 pediatric.
And again, I'm a little...
Which section is that? Right?
So it's just below that. So under section number 2, subsection 1,
okay.
Then you go down to B, you say maintain PAL certification, moderate sedation for pediatric patients age 8 years or younger, must be administered via an oral, intranasal, intramuscular route. Patients must be ASA 1, ASA 2. Then 1303 here.
So what happened? I'll go back to that word highlighted in the yellow, the intervention. This, they do not, in Mississippi, they do not have a moderate sedation clause that's only, it's only oral. And they don't, their pediatric designation is 8 years to 12 years of age. So that's why we had to change it to 8. The reason I highlighted in yellow was because our 1302 allows for intravenous moderate sedation. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I highlighted that. Then I put the question marks on how we want to change that or address that. So that's what's going on there. Let's go down to the minimal sedation. They do not have a minimal sedation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we would add this group. The same age group would be added to this less than 8 years of age. And that's why we got that. Now, the 1303 there, I just kind of put together the pediatric endorsement. I did it two ways. I got that with the 60 hours with the consulting anatomy and the medical evaluation, and then I listed that. So that could basically go either way. It's thought best to list it or just leave it in the paragraph, that's fine. I would tend to go the listing route where you've got the different things. I think it highlights it. And then I crossed out the 25 hours of didactic because, again, we're looking more for 60. And go down to B, attendance of the board-approved course, which includes 25 live patients. This is consistent with other states. Other states, for somebody that's not a...
Well, it's 25. Is it 20? So I guess maybe it's just a confusing number because it's 25 under age of 8, whereas right now... If someone's just getting a moderate sedation permit and they're going through the 60 hours of didactic, they only need 20 court cases on any age. Is that correct?
Right.
So you're saying you got to do the 20.
We can go back to the 20. I mentioned 25 just because some other states have reached the 25. I'm just mimicking, I think, Texas and California have reached 25. I don't have a problem going to 20.
So all 20 have to be peaked?
Yes. This is for a new effort.
Right.
This is strictly for a new applicant that has not gone to an accredited CODA training program.
See, what I'm getting at.
What this is, Randy, yeah. If somebody goes and takes a weekend course,
yes.
And this is why you got to do some live patients. There's some courses that know. And if you're dealing with kids less than 6, then I think that's why I've established a little higher caseload. 20 is certainly fine.
Well, what I'm kind of going here, like I think about Dr. Snell, who does a lot of this type of anesthesia, and he doesn't do many kids. So all he would, and another doctor like him, but all he'd have to do is do the 60 hours of didactic in 20 cases. As long as he's above the age of 8 years old, he's good. And then below 8, he needs a pediatric designation, which is an additional 25 ped cases.
Well, I think that was more than
20. Okay. I mean, I'm kind of curious how you feel about that. I mean,
yeah, I don't know that people should. I mean, I think if you went to a accredited residency, got the experience, you should be able to do it. The weekend guys, I don't know that they're doing it anyway. So my question would be, I think Eddie brought it up last time, is the need really there for the pediatric designation? I like the concept. I just don't know if it's actually needed. I don't think we're having issues with that in the state. It doesn't bother me because I don't think that people that take a weekend course are going to be intravenously sedating kiddos.
I think we're all just kind of being proactive. Right. You talked about that. So I think since we're redoing everything, we should at least have something in there.
Well, this is Brady. For Mississippi, what they decided to do for that kind of similar category of what we're talking about here, they wanted them to get 60 hours to do an IV course because of management of emergencies. And you look at PALS and ACLS, it's establishing IV line and intravenous line and dealing with emergency drugs and that pathway of learning. So that you have those 20 cases of doing IV sedation. The pediatric endorsement part of it was on top of that, the 10 live patient experiences, which is not to be confused that they're actually doing that. They are involved with the sedation in the dentistry because you're not going to have a teaching organization that's going to have liability coverage to teach on pediatric kids in that environment. And so the teaching organizations call them live patient experiences for that reason. So 20 and then plus 10
that they'd be a part of.
That's correct. And then the other thing with the intravenous routes for moderate sedation, especially in kids, is that that's a very, 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 that therapeutic window is very, very narrow to threat. And so we just said we don't want to run into complications with this particular route of administration for kids for this level of sedation provider.
This is Snell. That'd be my question to any provider doing intravenous sedation to a kiddo. Why are we sedating them? Probably because of behavioral reasons, and then they're going to sit there and allow me to start an IV if they're not allowed sitting there. I mean, I just don't, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense that that's
this is very
moderate sedation, right? You could do ketamine darts, all that, but that's not moderate sedation.
I promise you there are providers out there that do that, though. Yeah, as crazy as that sounds, they exist. That's why it was a delineation.
This is Christensen. I think along with what Dr. Blaze was saying, Dr. Lott, what you put together, as far as the 60 hours of didactics, if you included that, I think you said if you just, were we planning on just including that, the 22 of those hours have to do with these, that going to be kind of.
No, it's going to be the piece that we're looking at 60 hours.
All 60 hours of piece, as you're going to state.
I mean,
is
that class
exist?
What's
that?
Is that class?
They have, for the 1303, they did.
Okay.
There's several that are like
for feet.
Yeah. Okay. The docs does a feet one now, and I think they have live patients. Not live questions. They have patients that they actually do sedation. And things like that. They do 60 hours. You know, my specialty is we've got a sedation course every year that 22 hours is basically a review of everything. Mm-hmm. But I know some places in the valley have taken that course and then they've started to do sedation. And there's no live patients. But the American Academy of Pediatrics Act offers it to non-pediatric dentists. So that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of meant to be a review, but then that people end up taking that course and then they go in and they start doing sedation.
Okay. So will that be for the moderate, this is Chris, will that be for the moderate sedation then?
The one that I'm talking about.
Well, for both. I mean, is it going to be pretty much the same?
I put that in for the moderate.
60 hours too, if you want.
Right. Just to be comprehensive.
Okay. So the 22 is going to come out then.
The 22 is going to be removed. Correct. Because I know that's confusion and everything. I did that on the 1303.
This is the guy. The question on it, I guess this is kind of related to grandfathering, right? So what if you have a dentist currently with a 1302 that doesn't have documentation of COTA or the didactic hours, but he's done 30 pediatric cases in the last year. Are we going to grandfather that person into a 1303P? Or
I guess that is a question for the committee. I don't think that would be the subcommittee.
Right. Because I mean, that's the thing I'm looking. This makes a lot of sense for somebody applying for the first time, but we may have providers out there that have been safely taking care of pediatric patients, and they maybe don't have.
Well, I know in our renewal applications we have that.
Right. That'd be the 20 in 2 years that they fall under that.
Yeah. But it wouldn't be the 60 hours of didactic.
I don't think
right?
That's correct.
This is Brady. This is strictly for new applicants.
That's correct. The educational pathways are kind of moving target, right? So to penalize people that have been doing it safely for years doesn't really make sense. I mean, you can buy currency to them. They are already current doing this. I think that's how you handle it. And you say, okay, when you're reapplying, you're filling out an attestation I've done X amount of cases, pediatrics, I wish to include a pediatric endorsement on my renewal application. So yeah, I would support this for a new permit process.
Do we need to
necessarily?
Does that even grandfather into the rules somehow?
This is Christian. What about continuing education then too? I mean, one thing to have the cases, but
I know 1303, you have to take 30 hours in your review.
In the five-year
ban, you've got to show 30 hours of similar to what's listed here, physical, national, station, medical, emergency.
This is great. We'd have to review the rules. I do think that it does have that language, though, for all permit providers. I would assume so.
I think 1301,
1303 has that.
I know that one, but I think it's probably.
This is Chris's. I think most of it has to do with just anesthesia itself versus, you know, peds.
Sure.
That's a good point. Very good point. My question is, can we pass that with the subcommittee to look into the educational currency part for the endorsement? Is that something we can broaden the scope of this?
Sure, session? Yeah. Sure.
I think it's appropriate for us to look into that. For the renewal process.
Dr. Lau, I have a question for you. So on page 3 and 4, bottom of page 3, where it's 1302P, moderate sedation staffing requirements, I was always under the impression that the pediatric designation was just for 8 and under, but it starts talking about ages 9 years of age and older, and then on page 4, it starts talking about ages 13 and older.
This is strictly Mississippi, so we have.
So that's not what you're proposing on here. Okay.
So all the ages should be 8 and under.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Good question.
And up there in red, we kind of did that. Or down there in red, that's what kind of go along with all the purpose.
This is Brady. I can speak on that a little bit with Mississippi. They didn't want the 1303 or the minimum sedation permit holder in Mississippi. What they did is, okay, you could use some like over the counter, or not over the counter, but something you can prescribe to take at home type of sedative, right? Plus nitrous, and that would put you in this like little category. They didn't want to see that within that age group, so they specified that 8-12 for that. That was the reasoning behind that. So it may not really fit with what our regulations.
Okay. Yeah, I would say just keep it at 8 years old.
Right.
And so that brings up another point that I'm hoping I read the same way I think that Dr. Snell read at this point. Sorry. Under the anesthesia staffing requirements, you indicate that if you're a maxillofacial surgeon, or they do on your document, the assistant must be PAL certified also, which I think is maybe a typo or a overlook from.
Yeah, we did. We didn't address that.
Because none of the other designations require it, only the 1301 maxillofacial surgery, which again I think is onerous and not necessarily needed.
I don't like, I certainly can't argue.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Snell. That's, I agree with Dr. Blazek, and that's just one concern that I have with writing new rules, is it just seems to start putting its tentacles into places and keep going, and do we really have a problem where it needs to be written? That's my concern with doing new stuff.
Right.
I don't know that we understand the unintended consequences of choices, even though they may be perceived to be doing a good.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's come up, I think, for Eddie and I, because we have, you know, talk to the oral surgeons in the state, and I will say that more than 40% feel that because of our training, we shouldn't need a pediatric designation. And the consensus came out of
the numbers that we looked at in terms of the study that indicated the adverse occurrences that have occurred in the state over the past 9 to 10 years, none of them have involved an oral surgeon in a pediatric case. And we feel some of this PED designation is to verify that someone who's getting postgraduate training or not postgraduate training is actually being trained to sedate or put kids to sleep. And we are in agreement with that. But we feel as someone who's gone through a residency, like Dr. Brady has, Holly Magaya, and yourself, that, you know, sometimes this is a bit too much. It's more regulation. And so our constituency really feels that we shouldn't even have the age limit. And we feel like the documentation or the research supports it. And that's not just our study. It's the one out of California. It's the one out of Texas. And as much of what we would consider our closed claim summary through OMSNIC, that really our complications with PEDS, they're just not there. So, you know, Eddie and I have been trying to tell them, look, we think that this is a good thing for us to do as a board, and it's moving in the right direction. You know, and so I certainly think you can garner Eddie and I support on this, but you know, from a state level, it was
difficult. I think out of our meetings that we've had, I think the biggest concern is just, and I can't speak for anybody, I'll speak for myself, is just some type of verification that cases are done on the younger kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people do have some current issues of doing these cases that are up to date. I believe that's probably what the committee has said for the most part. I'm not speaking to you, Jason.
This is Brady. Yes, that is true. There was also a concern I brought up with Eddie.
Yeah.
Potential royal running royal locations and running into emergencies where now you're kind of in a conundrum with currency. And we talked about potentially, correct me if I'm wrong, Eddie, but we talked about entertaining the idea that if they were doing modern sedation, that could be something that could be done.
Yeah, and I kind of put this in the verbiage.
Yeah,
you did, right.
And yeah, I kind of, and we talked about that of other ways of getting it worked with another person at the same permit.
Right.
Doing intravenous modern sedation, get used to it. Sometimes you're giving person that to kids when you do. Right.
Yeah, you kind of take care of that. 5-year-old or whatever,
got
it's something like that. We had talked about maybe considering those. Because one of the problems with the Cindy guys is that some of those guys weren't able to get those.
Couldn't get the modern sedation.
And we proposed a smaller number, but the committee thought that 10 would be appropriate number. So that's why in the verbiage we put different options to achieve those cases.
This is Hero. Is the intent of the caseload meant to be that the oral surgeon is providing the sedation himself, or they're bringing in an anesthesiologist and seeing the child? Can that count towards their caseload as well?
Yes.
Yep.
It can.
If they're working with them or they're collaborating with them.
I think that's appropriate. Because otherwise, it's almost a deterrent to work with.
If they brought in Jason, if they brought in Holly, and they're working with them, they're talking about
doing
that, see how they do all that stuff. But we thought that was
appropriate. And that'd be consistent with all
his
permits.
This was just more for the
anesthesia. Okay.
This is Begay. So, you know, Dr. Blazing's point about oral surgeons requiring the PE, you know, I look at it and I'm like, well, that's going to be really easy for oral surgeons to obtain, right? Because most of us, you know, everyone's been a residency, most of them take care of kids. But it does make me wonder if it's going to be so easy for oral surgeons to get. Is it necessary? I think in the 1302 and the 1303, where you might have the dentist who did a weekend course or didn't do a course at all, you know, and wants to be able to take care of kids, that is much more concerning in my mind that it's really necessary. But I think, you know, Randy brings up a good point of, you know, in my mind, you guys tell me in the community, I think most oral surgeons probably treat more than 20 kids under 8 in a year, right?
That is great. I would disagree. I think that's the conundrum. That's kind of like that's the number that's on the bubble.
I think a lot of the oral surgeons, and again, I opened this up to the floor, I think a lot of them did really have children in the hospital. And that was kind of the gentleman from Mississippi that a lot of times they're doing really young kids in the hospital and not getting special problems. There's emergent situations where you do have to leave the child.
Right.
So that's why it's kind of difficult to get that kid's load of number of people left there too.
Mm-hmm. That actually was my other question regarding the case numbers. If you bring in another anesthesia provider, that does not count towards your case number?
No, it does. No, it does.
If you're working with them, yeah. If it's the same, say if Randy brings in another, or he's working with a fellow oral surgeon in his practice, it's a 13012, that would count.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is Brady. It's kind of like the trust system too, right? And obviously you can bring someone in and be like, call me when he's ready to roll and just walk in and walk out, no different than like in a hospital setting. But we don't want to make it so onerous that it's not obtainable for someone. We want to make it kind of a community learning experience too, because if you're kind of flying too low of numbers, you want that built into your system. Same with piloting, like you can't, you're not night flight turn unless you put so many times. Same analogy. That's what that came to. I think a lot of the oral surgeons is correct. You guys ran your numbers back in your systems and realized, well, this is kind of a harder number to obtain. And so then the discussion became, well, what if it's 6 and under versus 12 and under, and how does that change the dynamics of it?
Is that number onerous even counting cases you're taking to the hospital or bringing in?
Well, so that's what's kind of funny. So Eddie and I presented it, I think, as, look, we think that 8 probably a good age because it's going to be easy to make those numbers, just like we're all talking about here. And the response was, we shouldn't even have to have it. So then we were like, well, okay. So then we tried to like talk to them and say, look, this is the goal we're trying to pursue here, and we're trying to make it easier, you know, for you to get the numbers. And I think in the end, they really kind of trust Eddie and I to help, you know, move this along and provide safer anesthesia, and the majority of them realize, look, if I want to do 6 and under, I got to prove competency and proficiency, and if I want to do 8 and under, I got to prove it. But that was the dividing line. Guys were like, 8 and under, you know, or 6 and over, let's just flip it. That's a no brainer. Do them all the time, you know. Whereas 6 and under are the ones either you're bringing someone in, or you're going to the OR, or what have you. And so maybe that is the better number, we thought, because if you're making them be safe on those younger kids. But then I flip it and I look at the dentist and I look at the minimal sedationist and I'm like, oh man, no, I don't want them touching it. 8, 6, 8. They can't make that judgment. They don't have the training to say, this is a kid I can do in my office by myself or whatever. You know, just work. So I kind of like a little stricter on 8, and I say, I'm going to suck it up to make it safer for these other guys that aren't really as well trained, you know. So I think Eddie and I, we kind of heard from our constituency, and I think we have the ability to move in that fashion. And people would go with both 6 or under, 8 or under. I personally think the 8 or under is a better number.
This is Dr. Snell. I don't think anyone would question someone that went and got a weekend course and compare that to someone that did a residency type of situation. And if the aim of this is to help keep those that did weekend courses from seeing the 8-year-olds, why don't we put the verbiage towards that rather than making a blanket statement to everyone?
They have to be accredited
even today. Because I don't know what the weekend courses are. I'm not saying they shouldn't. If they get the training in PEDS at the weekend course and they, you know, we all know clinic experience is very valuable. So if you're doing it over and over and over and you're safe with it, that's awesome. That's great. I'm not here to say that if you do a weekend course, you can't sedate PEDS at all. But if the aim of it is to those providers, because we just feel like maybe they need some more training experience, and then does the language need to go to those that have had a residency done and had that experience?
This is great, because one of the concerns I have with that is, regardless if you're a resident or not, what if I took a job as the dean of
AT's bill for 10, 20 years or whatever. I've never touched a child for a very long time, right? And then I decided to shift gears. That's kind of the conundrum that you run into. You don't know if people's backgrounds are coming into the system, right? If they're not current and then they all of a sudden want to do children, then that's the safety net that we're trying to build here. And I don't think it's dependent on what you did 10, 20 years ago.
I completely agree with that. But if this is a new applicant and I'm coming straight from a residency,
that's true.
Versus if this is is geared towards new applicants, I think that's a difference. And you can put that in the language of, you know, finish a residency within the last X amount of years. If not, then you need to provide documentation of X amount of cases, and we're going to treat you just like someone that is coming out of a weekend course type of thing.
This is Brady. Thanks for the clarification. Yeah, this is more for renewal process, not for initial application, because initial applications, they are codified. There's only two, like dentist, anesthesiologist, and organized patient surgeon. And so we took that number from their standards of CODA so that we have delineated that knowledge. It's what do you do for the people?
The research coming back
in.
This is Bagai. I think I mentioned this a couple of meetings ago too, and Dr. Blazer reminded me, I just keep thinking of the 1302 permit holder who's given IV sedation. And that age of 8 and under, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in my mind, I start worrying about a general dentist that provides sedation safely often to, 7-year-olds, right? And then in comes, a 20-month-old that had some injury and they think, oh yeah, well now I can sedate this kid, and I just think of that range of development and changes in volume of distribution and everything else that happens from, infancy through age 8. I mean, it's such a huge spectrum. And I don't even try and say, okay, we have a P under 8 designation and a P under 4 designation. I mean, that's never. I guess I'm just expressing concern. And also in your example, Jason, I would much prefer that you meet a sugar mom and cruise the Caribbean for 10 years and then get back to practice.
There you go. I like it.
Forget the dean. I mean, that's crazy.
This is Christensen. So, Ali, are you saying that you prefer like a 6 and under?
I'm just talking about my concern, I guess. I don't think I'm proposing anything. I'm just sitting here I'm thinking of the weekend course, the weekend to perform too, which you can't get 60 hours in a weekend. But, I'm just thinking of public safety. That's kind of what I don't know how to put that in rule. And to me, it would make it very complicated. And I don't like things complicated. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around that for, especially the 1302, where you've got an IV and, as Dr. Brady mentioned, the window of the margin of error is pretty narrow.
Yeah, I'm happy to add verbiage to the first two phrases.
Yeah.
That's usually
we can. Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a balance. We don't want to write these rules to the lowest common denominator necessarily,
right.
But, we at the same time want to come up with solutions that are going to be safe for the public. So it's good to express it.
Yeah, it's hard to.
Dr. Snell, Dr. Bray, just a quick question. You said it's written for the renewal process. So what's the 60 hours? Is that during the course of 5 years, you need to, or is that?
No, that's the initial.
That's the initial, right? So it is for initial
applicants. For someone that's not CODA trained, that's the initial.
For someone that's not CODA trained,
that's
the initial.
Trained.
Gotcha.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. So, Dr. Bobby, you're comfortable?
I'm comfortable with the discussion.
Okay.
And
I'll move forward with some of these changes.
Great. Thank you.
I'll present it to the subcommittee.
Appreciate it. Great.
That was good work. I think that this is definitely on the right track. A clean version would just make it easy to run through it and, have it out the week before the next meeting, and we'll be able to hammer this, I think.
I can further refine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good conversation.
Mm-hmm.
great. I just want to do thank our oral surgery components for looking at this. I mean, it's a hard pill to swallow for anyone. It's like, wow, you know, this is a regulation that we haven't tripped up on, and yet, you know, they want to accept this type of new regulations, but to understand the theory behind it. I know that's a hard stuff for both of you guys. I really appreciate your guys' efforts to reaching out to the community. Mm-hmm. It sounds like we still have some work to do. But thank you for your efforts.
Thank you. No different than you or Ollie or anything. For all of us, I think this blazing, for all of us in this room, it's a fine line between this overregulation and, you know, we've been doing a fine job all these years, you know, what's going on, but it is a movement across this country, obviously. You know, so. Mm-hmm.
Ryan, do you or staff have any input on
talking
about right now?
Sorry, I was just talking to Christina in the hall. what we're thinking of doing is contacting, this was Mary's suggestion, by the way, contacting like my peer, our peer group across, sorry, just put a net, across the U.S. jurisdictions and find out, one, do you have pediatric designation? Two, what is it? Is it through statute or is it through rule? And then also CRNAs and the capabilities or the abilities for them to go into the practice without like work from a dentist or the CRNA just holding it another. Because I'll find out, because there's a couple that I pointed out already, like Oregon does well.
So in Florida,
I was looking up.
Florida as well.
I'm not an advocate of this, but Florida's rules only allow CRNAs to sedate to the level of the permit holder. Physician anesthesiologist can sedate to any level appropriate. Those were some of the bigger changes with Florida, because we talked about Florida before. So
yeah.
I think that direction is what the committee is trying to avoid, and that's why I think Dr. Brady originally brought up the idea of trying to work with the other board, which everybody likes. It's just a matter of we can't do it through rule, we know that, so how can we do it?
And the statute, based on what Mary's talking about through the sunrise process, wouldn't reside in any particular board's chapter. It would reside in probably title
41.
Or
no,
it's
32.
It could be 38,
32. It's one of
them. Too many titles. I think for our committee, what we should look at, though, is what you had talked about, is that alternate plan. We do run into this roadblock. And I think to Ollie's point, it's better for us to work together right now.
Right.
Than to have another, and excuse me, I'm not trying to stand in flames, but another surprise that's stuff going to the dental community where we're trying to recognize. And so I think it may be appropriate for us to have this type of discussion.
Absolutely.
Right now. And I won't get it confused with Sunset.
Thanks. All right.
So Ryan, do you want us to provide a definition of pediatric endorsement for the statutes? I know there's a lot of definitions of different things.
Well, you probably don't even want to know what's going on.
That long and have somebody that's, that
yeah, doesn't. It would help because right now Jessica Thomas, who's on the phone. In fact, I maybe just defer to her and ask her what her opinion is. Are you here, Jessica? And can you hear us okay to answer that question that Dr. Lau just presented?
I am here. I'd be happy to answer any question, but could you repeat the question for me?
So Dr. Lout was asking, do we as staff, and then you help us as staff, wish to receive a definition of pediatric designation, or is that what you said?
Designation, endorsement.
Endorsement, something like that we can insert.
So I think that the most helpful is probably going to be trying to put all of these suggestions and all of these various options, including the two document suggestions that were sent out in preparation for this meeting, including the stuff from Mississippi, including the draft I think that came from Mr. Snell, and putting it all into one draft so that you can see all of the various options and changes that you're discussing for a current rule. And that would include, you know, having in the margins and in the draft that you're looking at anything that deals with adding a new permit or some sort of endorsement to an existing permit, any of that. I think it's going to be helpful for the committee to look at a single draft that presents all of the options that need to, that they need to make a decision on.
Okay. Awesome. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. This is Vlad again. Would that be the notice of proposed rulemaking? You want us to incorporate it into that document?
Well, if you just let...
That's why we've got to get this refined a little bit. But,
yeah.
Yeah. It would, so that's what she... Jessica's referring to the notice of proposed rulemaking, and then drawing in Dr. Snell's, Dr. Lau. I think that was it, right? We got those yesterday. Put those all into one document, the Mississippi, whatever you guys are picking from Mississippi, also all into the same NPR, which is notice of proposed rulemaking.
Dr. Gray, I have one question. What about the permit subcommittee? Do we want to start to show that work at this point, or are we going to wait? How do we
show the work regarding like memorandum of understanding?
No, not the memorandum of understanding. That's not an obtainable pathway, but the draft that our subcommittees are working on as far as what that language would look like.
Yeah, I think it's appropriate to keep that conversation going.
So, can I make a suggestion? This is not again. Can we kind of further refine these documents? Kind of do that and then slowly? That might be an easier course to follow.
I agree. Okay.
One question on the part of the adjusting the permits in the 1304. Is that in the purview of this committee, or is that something that Dr. Brady, Dr. Blazing, Dr. German, and I would just get our heads together and we get talking to our lobbyists because it has to be legislation? Is that even something we should be discussing in this committee if it's now moving to more of a association level, lobbyist level running up there?
This is Brady. My idea was to have this alternate pathway figured out, an ideal pathway and alternate pathways within our subcommittee, and then have both of those languages. It's just integrating it into this massive proposal that we will start to chip away and say, okay, we agree on this, except we don't agree on this, or whatever we're going to do with that. So we still have some homework to do. And I think when we get that, we can let them decide on, I guess, integrating that or if we're just putting it on hold. Either way, I think we have to find solutions. So we know that what happened with the bill. But we do understand that there is a big pressure to have some solutions with permits, especially with how people are feeling disenfranchised or being able to work when they feel like they have a right to work. So I think that question is a big, broader question than what we're even working with here. And so I think we need to look into those things about temporary permits and being able to have someone work within the first year coming out of training, or however we're going to work on that, whether that's with live patients or simulation. We have a lot of work to do with that. That may be in parallel with the alternate.
This is the guy that, the 1301 attempts, I think, is something we discussed. But I think that'd be within the purview of the committee, right?
Yeah.
1304, the alternate plan, I guess I haven't heard of the alternate plan.
So this is Brady. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but we were asked last meeting, say, okay, we want you guys to think about if the dental board is unable to permit non-dental providers because they see that as oversight or infringing on their jurisdiction, what can we do with how it stands now to help with the problems that we're facing for non-permanent anesthesia providers?
Wouldn't that just be leave it as it is?
But isn't isn't that what got us to where we are and why we had that Senate bill to begin with?
Right. But well, if there's no change, then the same thing
is going to repeat itself.
Right. But I think, you know, like you mentioned, the face of the legislature is good thesis. You guys go fix this in committee. Yeah, basically, do it, right? I think if we go back to the legislature together and say, we figured it out in committee, but we were told that we can't do it. But we want to do it here. And look, we've all come together, this is what we want to do, and we run a bill together, it's just going to be, you know,
it'll go right through.
It'll go right through.
So, this is late. I guess it's inappropriate for us to get too much into the weeds about the process because it's not on the agenda.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. So I think we refine our language, what we've worked on so far. The next meeting is September 17th, I think, or something like that, or something. And it's on the agenda. And hopefully we have counsel and we can really hammer this out and understand the process, like, and work backwards. When does the next legislative session start? How do we introduce it? Because that is obviously the way it's going to have to go. And we both have respective lobbyists that can help us negotiate that. We talked about the probationary period. Is that a topic we can move on to? Or not probationary, the provisional permit. Can we move on to that topic?
Sure. Yeah. I want to add one thing, too. This is Christian. Go ahead.
For clarification for me and Dr. Lau, for staff, the recommendations that we just submitted, I know they were really late. Because I think a lot of the stuff that's in the notice of proposed rules in here is old, like the levels that I had talked about beforehand, and it's all like kind of convoluted within here. So do we need to go through and clean up what's in here? Because a lot of this stuff was just proposed that hasn't been officially accepted, but I think it's all getting added and it's going to make it way more convoluted when we try to go through it. So do we want to task, but like, I don't know. Do you want me to just, because the edits that I made yesterday or for that I sent in were just for that one document. It had nothing to do with what was on here. It was just the.
I did like 14 red lines in the third and fourth section. I love red lined documents, so I'd be happy to go through and put in what we've actually like agreed to and where we I don't mind going through the document and taking that off to get the plate. I don't mind doing that. I mean, it's kind of there. Yeah, there's definitely things that, have adjusted. I think there's some changes to the P that you wanted to, though, after today. Maybe you email me that. I can try and put it all in one document with all the stuff that we've agreed to.
Well, so this is blazing. And so this is more a point of clarification, Dr. Hero. So the goal is for us to create one single document of proposed rule changes that goes to staff, and then staff presents that to the board.
Yeah.
And then the board kind of goes through it and deciphers the different sections and what have you. And obviously, because you're on the board and Dr. Christian's on the board, you're able to help them understand the various languages that we've put in there.
And typically, the way the process would work, especially when a committee this size and not this long, the board will probably just adopt whatever the recommendation is.
So at some point or another, this entire committee has to review this entire document and agree to everything that that one document says.
Yes.
Okay. Even though I would agree with Ali that we made some, like, oh, that's a good one. Let's all agree on that one. And we had motion or whatever, which none of us really knew
that
was the right way to go or not. I get you. And then,
it's just cleaner, I think.
And then like this document I see in this gray margin, is that an area where you can type extra things or something like that?
Well, I think it's just the PDF.
Oh, Snell, this is what you put in here.
From a long time ago.
Oh, that's a long time ago. Okay. I got you.
So I don't mind going through it and making the changes that I originally did and going back and taking those off, but this is a PDF and I don't have that live document to be able to do that with based on what's in here.
Well, it's in a Word. We do have a Word. You sent it Saturday, right?
Everything that we send is always in PDF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I converted.
Yeah, I heard the word somehow.
Yeah, I got it too.
I have the new one that says it has all the rules that pertain only to sedation anesthesia, but I don't have this comprehensive document in the Word.
Yeah, so we originally sent out to you what the current statute, or sorry, the current rules are now, and then I think you guys amended from that. And then Jessica has since, and we do get a Word document from her, and then we convert that to a PDF to send to you. So it's just the technology that we have to use is a PDF format of Adobe, so that's why it comes out that way. We can send you a document. So like what Jessica was talking about is blending everything together, Dr. Snell was saying, and then you guys go through what you want versus what you don't want. She's probably going to have questions as it relates to going through GIRC as opposed to not getting through GIRC. She's an attorney, former GIRC rule writer. So she has much more familiarity with what GIRC will be looking for as opposed to what they will allow or not allow. Regarding legislation, I know that Dr. Blazek has said that, and Mary, everybody's a doctor. Dr. Mary said that it can't go on the, yeah, you are, JD, I forgot about that. Dr. Williams said that it can't go on the, we can't talk about it because it's not on the agenda. To wait to put it on an agenda, right now we don't have another meeting. This is the last one scheduled. We'll figure that out later on the agenda today for other meeting dates. Generally, if the state board or any state agencies involved in legislation, they want to know about it by November 1st. But if you want to meet with your lobbyist, the medical board, their lobbyist, I can get you in contact with these people. Because if it's going to take that group effort anyway, then you should start doing that. Waiting on the board to opine on this and saying, yeah, that they agree or disagree.
You don't need
to. It's not likely going to go. And you don't need the board's approval.
Right. Yeah, that's what I suggested. And we just not even have it be part of this committee. We just, as professional.
As your professional private citizen, go out and move the.
Do our.
This is Chris. I think, what about, you know, we're talking about, you know, the anesthesia subcommittee that we have here. We're talking about, you know, the pediatric anesthetization and things of that nature. I think it's an appropriate time, too, to address the, as far as safety, a lot of the mortality that we've had has come from untrained team members, okay, and particularly the case in Yuma, where we don't have the appropriate training. I think it's we should tackle that as well, what the requirements are for some of our assistants, and also what they can do in the office with sedation and with emergency response. There's a good outline in the state of Washington that just basically states that our assistants can give IV medications under direct supervision from the physician there in the room. They're telling them what to draw, what they can give. And so I think it's a good time, appropriate time. Maybe our subcommittee can take that on too and add the verbiage that we need for our citizens and team members to help us. And I think that would lend to safety as well as clarification on a lot of things.
Which is this is Brady. I think we should open that up.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important topic.
It is, and it turns on.
I think the should we tackle it with the Peace Committee? Is this for
I think that's appropriate. I see that as being appropriate.
Okay. Because you have the auxiliary staff, excuse this Blazek, and you kind of address the auxiliary staff and the Peace Committee, and I think that's what we're talking about. That, again, I'll go back to Dr. Snell. I think the way you run your show is like awesome. I mean, you had that same assistant been with you all those years. She's been trained in different things, and I think whenever you go to an office, you have someone there. You know, that when you're providing anesthetic, that the other person knows what's going on. You're not walking in single-handedly to an office and you're relying on the dental assistant and the dentist to be your primary people in case of an emergency. And I know that you guys do something very similar. I know sometimes the CRNA has multiple providers. And I think that's something that is certainly paramount to the delivery of safe anesthesia is the team that you have there. And I think the fees would be a great one to use on that. And I think you already have those members there, so I don't want to muddy the water.
This is very, I think the people that are represented within the team already have a good representation as well to have that discussion.
I never did it. Someone has a lower level training than an RN for Chris Cross. That's the thing. I
can't. Well, what this is LASIK. So what's happening, I would say, in the world of oral surgery is what I would say the reality and the goal. So the reality of oral surgery across this country is that we bring on dental assistants and we train them not only ourselves but through Cal Amos has a program, California Association of Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons, and the American Association of Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons have specific programs where we send our assistants and they get trained to understand medications, dosages, concentrations, how to administer them under the direct supervision of the oral surgeon. And the premise is that we are going to then have someone in case of an emergent situation that can assist us with the delivery of medications. So what happens is when you're giving anesthesia and you're going to push a cc or percent or something of that nature, you will hand in hand work with your assistant while they draw up the cc or percent or something of that nature and give it into the intravenous line. In this state, a lot of the oral surgeons will send their assistants to the IV course, which is given through Gateway College, and their assistants go through the same IV course that an RN goes through or an LPN goes through, so that they become certified in starting IV. And so the reality is that it's going on already, and people want us to say, well, what makes you say that your assistant is qualified to do that? Well, it's because we've been training them like this for 20 years or more, and there is now a push through Amos and other individual states to actually make this part of statutes. It happened in Washington, it happened in California, and we believe it's time that, you know, we do have this idea of a team anesthesia delivery system. And that's kind of how it starts. That's what that comes
in. Some states, and this is Christian, some states actually have that in their statutes or bylaws, what they can do. So it has some language. I'd like to get it adopted here if we can.
Yeah, this is Dr. Snell. If you look at the Arizona for dental, there's virtually nothing on assistance when it comes to anesthesia and sedation.
Right.
So some people are taking the liberty. I've worked with some 1302 providers that their assistants start all the IVs, and they say, well, it doesn't say they can't. It doesn't say really? That they can either. So, but it's just silent, and so people are interpreting whatever they want to interpret from that because there is nothing on
well,
it.
Well, they're not licensed, but they're not regulated either.
Well, some will say, well, they went and did a phlebotomy course, or they went and, but again, there's just nothing out there. So I can't fault them. There's nothing written that says they can't, I guess, but... You know, so anyway, it's just left up to interpretation.
Well, it'd be a good conversation. Maybe to have.
I agree. Forward.
So
this is great stuff.
And it's our last meeting.
I thought we had one together for September.
We did.
My calendar.
I misspoke. It's, okay. I think it's September
17th. Okay.
And then another one in October. In October, yeah. I'm not crazy. What's wrong with you guys? I'm September 17th.
What?
You were saying
October 18th, yes.
Somebody called me.
Okay, anything else?
In November 19th. Oh, you said that. I'm sorry.
And Christmas 24th. December 24th.
Christmas
24th. So, this is Dr. Neal. Dr. Hugh, would you want, and maybe this is for staff as well, do you want me to take what I just did with the definitions and put it into this document? And if so, how do I access this document to be able to do that so it shows up for everyone to see?
So, I think it's maybe a better question for Jessica, because I can give Dr. Snell the Word document, but then she's not in control of it anymore. How do you want me to go forward with that, Jessica? I know you sent me an email about chatting after the meeting, but what would you prefer?
So if what's included in the NPR is old suggestions that no longer apply based on how the discussions have panned out, then I would suggest doing two things, looking at the current NPR and making comments to remove any of those suggestions that are no longer applicable, and then also doing the same with those two additional documents from Dr. Snell and the information about what you are considering from Mississippi, and removing any portions of those two documents that are no longer applicable. And then if you'd like, I can add all three of the documents together in one Word document. And then if staff wants to give a Word document versus a PDF, that's between staff and their legal counsel. But I think just to get all of the suggestions and the current suggestions all on one page, I think it should be the first goal for the committee, so that you guys have one thing that you can look at to make decisions on in terms of what to recommend ultimately to the full board.
Thank you, Jessica.
Does that help? Yeah.
Clear enough.
Sure.
No, that was clear
as much.
Yes.
So I'll talk to you after the meeting, Jessica. And then, yeah, Dr. Hero sat on the rules group meeting. She's done this in the rules group on there was like four different things, not just one deck. And it's a big project. And so it's gone a little quicker, but anesthesia is a more complicated topic, I would assume. So I'll get with you, Jessica, and then I'll send something out to the committee to see if that's what they are looking for.
Okay.
This is Dr. Snell again. Just for my own benefit, if you guys, because there's a lot of oral sedation and conscious sedation terms, so I don't know if you saw, but it would make it easy for me if we could come to a consensus on what we want to say there, because it's just used so much that if I'm going to go through it and redo stuff, it'd be nice to use the verbiage that's going to be used. Because I put in there, like, instead of oral sedation for 1303, it was moderate sedation via an oral route. And that phrase, every time it said oral sedation, pretty much was had to be put in there, which to me seemed very
general instead of oral.
Yeah. Is that that
mm-hmm.
okay?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it should clarify the anesthetic depth that you're saying, sir.
It says moderate sedation, yeah. Because that's what 1303 is. They could do moderate, correct?
Mm-hmm. I know Mississippi's not. Or parenteral. 1303 is only enteral.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought what you did way back in the beginning was good.
Except for the levels. I threw all the levels off.
Yeah.
And it's consistent. Well,
I got the levels. It just really went up.
Everyone else.
When I used them.
Yeah.
I think it's consistent with what the ADA is doing. It's consistent with the ASA is doing, with the AMA is doing. Everyone is kind of changing their definitions to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Blazik. Do we want to talk about this probationary permit issue? Or do you wanna...
This is Brady. Most certainly do. I would say in our subcommittee, we just kind of really cursory talked about it on the surface. And do you feel like we're prepared to talk on the committee level with it? I mean, I'm fine doing what we kind of a little bit conceptually talked about. Should we start those discussions now, or would you want to put this down for another time?
Well, I would love to kind of get into it a little bit, and you know, we can limit it because of the sense of time. But again, I'll go back to, you know, kind of what I think that we're feeling in general as a group.
Great idea.
Is that we are a little bit concerned about the idea of giving someone a permit
without having some type of process that we've kind of assured that they're supposed to get a permit. You know, so what happened when we brought this up to the oral surgeons is they're like, what about the group for the guy that we gave a permit to and wasn't supposed to have one?
Photoshop.
Yeah, Photoshop. And you know, and we even did the evaluation. And you know, what are the optics if we give a provisional permit, let's say for a year, which is a really long time, we feel, and the individual who has this provisional permit has an adverse outcome, and then all of a sudden it gets out into the public persona, and the public is like saying, wait a minute, isn't the board supposed to protect us from things like this? And yet they're just giving, you know, provisional status and giving someone up to a year to get their true permit. So that's kind of where I would come at it beginning with.
This is great. I mean, it's valid. I mean, the only thing is that same individual would have had to been evaluated as well, regardless. So it's like Catch Me If I Can type movie.
Right.
So I understand the concern. I think it's such a red herring and a zebra. I mean, I hope history never repeats itself from that.
Yeah.
I don't know where we are with the securities of actually looking at credentials. I'm sure that it's strengthened at the board level to some degree because of the attention that it's brought.
Mm-hmm. So the purpose of the probationary period would be to expedite the permitting process so that the practitioner can serve,
correct?
Well, so... And I'll let board staff talk to this, but I think one area that's going to help staff issue these permits sooner will be, you want to talk about the switch with licensees expiration from June?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a Pandora's box, really. I mean, I don't know that staff is slow or the process is slow. I think part of what the issue is, and we get this all the time, Susie can probably opine on this more than me, but people will say they've completed something and we've sent them a note that says we're missing this. And then they call and we're like, so adding this in doesn't solve anything if they're still missing something. There's a couple things. One, you guys have probably heard that we were successful in the budget request to increase the amount that this board has appropriated to spend. So one of the things we're using the money for is to automate the renewal process, which will hopefully, fingers crossed, and we actually have a clause now that if they don't meet our deadline, that there's a certain reduction in the fee if they don't. So that will hopefully do it, and that should take place by January 1st. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I don't know how many are on
Dr.
committee.
Dr. Brownson's on the phone.
Oh, I don't know how many is on the committee. 11. Okay.
No, 10.
Yeah.
So we need Dr. Brownson. Dr. Brownson, are you present? Telephonically?
Yes. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you. We've lost a few in the room. We just want to make sure we saw the quorum. Sorry to...
Sorry.
Thank you.
So we're out as well with it. I know the staff gets overwhelmed and they work extraordinarily hard this time of year with the automated process and the staggered expiration dates. That will hopefully free up some time during residency completion so that as long as the applicant is getting everything in as they're supposed to, it'll probably expedite the permitting process, potentially negating the need for a probationary period.
Right.
And the other question I would pose is how valuable is the on-site evaluation, you know, and I know there's value to it. I know there's an education component to it for the applicant. That the scenario that we discussed of the forgery of an application, that wouldn't, whether he had an evaluation or not, that doesn't matter. You know, are we really reading bad apples out, so to speak, through this evaluation process? Probably not. So, and that's something that can certainly hold up the permit as well. So I would defer to the individuals who are seeking the 1301 permit, and we have a subcommittee for that. So I would encourage you just to really discuss the efficacy of the evaluation process. And that would be something that would potentially eliminate the need of a quote probationary period if there was one, the changes that we're making with the automated renewals and the staggered expiration dates, and secondly, potentially at the need for these evaluations.
This is the guy. I have a thought on it. For one, my personal opinion is that somebody who's gone through a 3-year residency in anesthesia shouldn't have to then have somebody come and watch a live patient, whether or not they know what they're doing. Perhaps the simulation would be appropriate. I thought the very nice kind of thrown that around. But then I also had a thought regarding regarding the provisional period or the temporary permanent road we want to put on it with the public optics of what happened with Goyle. Would it, if you could get, am I not allowed to say that?
No, sorry. No.
PTSD.
Sure.
But the thought that I had, and I'm interested, because really the provisional permit is most applicable to dental anesthesiologists, right? An oral surgeon can start working and making an income without having to do anesthesia, right? The dental anesthesiologist.
Kind of. I mean, it's a big part of their practice.
No doubt. But a dentist anesthesiologist can't make any money unless they go work in the general dentist.
They can start practicing dentistry.
We haven't done it in 3 years. Currency issue on the other end.
But here's a thought. In order to get, if there's concern of public perception, in order to be able to get a temporary, you have to be part of a group, right? So if I just get out of school and I join Brady's group, I can get a permit because I am in a group that the board knows I'm going to be receiving some mentorship and maybe a little bit of oversight to get started. Versus the guy that comes in and I'm just going to go buy all my stuff and I'm going to go. Just a thought to maybe make it so that it doesn't have any sort of perception of, oh, you're doing away with on-site evaluation, like just a few years ago, there was some guy that totally skipped all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a conversation you guys have can certainly have it in the subcommittee.
Can I say that since I'm not on the subcommittee? I think the provisional is very applicable for oral surgeons and dental anesthesiologists. For a 1302 for a holder, even myself that came out of a residency, I don't need to, for what you just said, like I don't need an anesthesia permit to for my livelihood. And it's debatable, a year of an anesthesia or a year of a GPR or AGD versus a dedicated 3-year, I got anesthesia, for 3 years. I mean, it's a big difference. So I would say the person that's coming out of a CODA, is the state of Arizona, do we believe in CODA and what they're producing and what they're doing? If we do, then they're safe to practice. And why do we have another evaluation for them? But for the other providers, I don't even think that'd be feasible to do any type of.
I guess my point is, if you did away with the evaluation process or changed it in some way, maybe take live patients off, because I think there's even sometimes an ethical question about that portion of it. And with the changes that our staff is making, that potentially eliminates the need for a probationary period. Because now it's expedited.
It's easy.
Yeah.
Goes quicker.
Right.
This is Blazing. So one thing I will say is I appreciate everyone engaging in this. And the reason I wanted to talk about it here as opposed to the subcommittee is that I felt like one of the greatest things that when Ollie and Dr. German and I all got together was we had a lot of conversation here about that topic. And then the first time we got together, we were able to, put everyone's thoughts and process through a sieve and then come out with these 3 or 4 main ideas. And so that's why I wanted to engage just a little bit here to kind of go through this. So thank you for indulging me. Why I am really kind of against the probationary thing is because I do believe that my oral surgeon compadres are not doing what they should be doing, okay? So I'm getting ready to go do an anesthesia evaluation really quick here. And I called the young man to ask him about, you know, what he's been told so far, what to expect, what to kind of plan for. And I did this because the last three that I have done have been very similar. Recent graduates, moving into a group practice, and I'm walking in thinking, oh, this will be a great evaluation. They're going to have everything lined up. And of course the kid knows what he's doing with anesthesia because he's been trained. And he certainly knew how to do anesthesia properly, but the office was a mess. Okay? And we always try to tell the individual, this is a learning experience for both of us. We're hoping you can learn, and chances are I'm going to learn a little bit of something. But what just happened in here when we were mock simulating an emergency was not done the right way. And here's why it wasn't done the right way. And unfortunately, going through a residency, you learn good anesthesia, and you've got everything at your fingertips as far as a crash cart, and you are forced to kind of learn it or whatever. But it's like going to dental school, they don't teach you about business. Going through oral surgery program, they don't teach you about setting up your own office and what it takes when you come out. And so unfortunately, these young residents are graduating, and they have no clue about a permit. And so they come out July 6th, and they're like, oh, I'm ready to rock and roll, and they put all the onus on Susie, and she's like, well, you got to complete the permit. And it's like, shame on the group you're in.
Right.
Because I know they didn't hire you July 4th. Okay? They hired you probably in April, and that they didn't educate you about getting your application in early, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to keep going down this road. I really believe in every surgeon that came to that meeting that I had 2 weeks ago was like, hey, man, this is a good thing. We need to make sure these offices are prepared at least at the 1301 level. Because when I go in and their O2 tank is in a completely different department, or their AMBU bag isn't out of the box, or they have LMAs in one area and laryngoscopes in another area and endotracheal tubes in another area, I don't stand for that. You know, that's bad anesthesia.
No.
You know, because they can't handle the most. So, you know, I know you're like, you know more than me for sure about how these things kind of snowball and then bad outcomes occur. So I'm all on, get your application in, man, and if it takes 50 days, it takes 50 days. You know, but we'll do our best to come in on site and out of it to make sure we know you don't have a good anesthesia, you came for an accredited program, get your things in order. And I, you know, I've been, I, yeah.
This is Brady. Yeah, Mayor, for sure. There's a difference between training, right, and learning everything versus applying everything, especially when everything's been handed to you. Versus you are applying your own supplies, materials, protocols, everything that's in place. See, you strike a tone with me with what you say. It's absolutely true. I always felt like, well, there is a big component because every, whatever walk of life you come from, oral surgery, EA, CRNA, MBA, office-based anesthesia is a different animal on its own. And we don't know how much applied learning you had with them. I mean, even if you did, how much did you really get out of it for the aspect of preparation? And so, it, for me, I've always been a big component of that. The prepared provider is much different in how outcomes play out versus someone that has the knowledge but is not prepared. And so, The latency of the DAs when they actually get permitted, it's a big headache, and there's a big, you know, pause and angst of, well, I'm coming out of residency, and if I'm not practicing, I'm becoming farther away from being able to practice. Therefore, I'm not as safe as I was from day one out of residency versus day 60 out of residency. So there is a fine balance between that. I think a lot of this comes from the undertones, not so much of complaints that we're going through that process, but because of the latency of the non-dentist permit provider going to the dentist. But the same argument that you had hold true with that situation as well. So I don't know what that solution is. You know, I think that's a very good conversation to have. Because there is a difference when you maybe you didn't realize, oh man, how did I not have, why am I not drawing on sucks? I'm doing general anesthesia. Someone's pointing that out to you. Right? So I tend to agree with what you're saying.
Dr. Snell, I think what Dr. Blazer, what you just said, opened my eyes as well, because having done a residency in a hospital, like I was at the VA hospital, but it was a dental clinic. And so my perception is probably skewed from what, like, it was office-based sedation. And so I'm taking what I, my vision and extrapolating it to what an oral surgeon or a DA went through. And if it's not office-based setting, then maybe there is some value in having an on-site evaluation to make sure that it's set up correctly and that you know the efficient way to handle an emergency versus what was in hospital. And I'm sure, now that you say that, the various settings from different residencies are going to vary greatly as well. Maybe some did get office-based settings, and maybe some were just exclusive to hospitals where everything was right there handed to them, and to understand the difference, there might be some value there for that.
So this is Brady. I think when we get down to maybe why we were trying to look at this, you know, more closely, is not to put you on the spot, Ali, but the biggest issue of the NIDIS was for the non-dental permit providers having an issue with how long it was taking for the 1304 permits. And we never really got to delineate if there's really a difference between like a 1304 permit dentist trying to get the permit, if that was equally as taxing or as hard as it was for like a 1301 permit. And I still don't know the answer to that. Conceptually, I want to say it seems like they're all about the same conundrum of time, like chips for car manufacturers. But
that's where the beauty of the new permit would come in. Now we're relying on the non-dentist anesthesia provider. They're taking care of all the emergency stuff and things like that. So, you know, what our goal would be is to permit the provider and not that dentist, right?
That's exactly right.
But you know, I am wholeheartedly agreeing with you, Dr. Brady, about like, do we really need to put a live patient to sleep for the examination? And I don't think that's really the issue here. I know those guys know how to put people to sleep. You know, it's really about the office and about their understanding of the medical equipment and that it's on site or whatever. You know, for 1301 permit holders, when that happens, I know it's you, right? Or I know it's you when you're going to the dental office, you know, and stuff like that. So I'm glad we're having this conversation because I've made some really good notes, and I think that when we do get together and want to come back with what our recommendations are, this allows that. And what I would say to the board, the art committee here, and what I am going to take the onus on it, because I'm heavily involved in our society, is we should be talking to our colleagues. And you know several CRNA groups, and you know all the VA groups, and say, listen, you guys, when you got a guy coming in, prepare him for the permit. Listen, get your stuff in early before you're out of school as much as you can. Have your director write that letter that says this person is graduating from an accredited program. And when they come out, they're ready to go early on, and then talk to your colleagues, you know, so that you're not having one of your guys in your group, credentialize a guy in your group. You say, hey, to the other group, you know, or to those surgeons, can you come, you know, help us out when it gets in here quickly? You know, the board has their list of evaluators, and we need more DAs to do the evaluations because that helps all of us 1301 guys. You know, I'm going to brandish many of my oral surgery colleagues at the next meeting in September the 23rd because I just am so disappointed in the past two that how poorly prepared the residents were, and they were going into group practices, five or more surgeons, and I was like, what are you doing? You got to prepare these guys for this as part of it. Mm-hmm. That's on them, really.
Right. Yeah. The bright side of local anesthesia, and I'm sure in your group you guys do the same thing, our carts are standardized, mm-hmm. so everything in each cart is in the same spot. So at least you don't have endotracheal tubes down the hallway.
Oh, yeah.
Just open the door to the sink. And that blows my mind that the setup was like that. You know, it's established practice. I'm good. I'd love to join the setup. Who's on the business? Just the two of you?
Yeah, there's four, and then there's an issue with numbers. You can't do it with certain size.
Even I'm not on it. This
probably will be a different subcommittee. Because this is really on the realm of the, well,
it is. It's not on a different subcommittee. It's on the one permitting. That's what we're talking about.
Oh, so you are on.
Correct. You're already on it, Ali.
We haven't really seen Ali.
Yeah, I grant your request.
You're on it. I'm off of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
The new point on the.
I have a sidebar for you. Okay. So this is interesting, and I wanted to raise your attention because, again, I want everyone to know how serious oral surgery is taking this concept of anesthesia. Okay. So our national meeting is at the end of September, and we have a House of Delegates, and we're going to be passing or presenting some new legislation, and I'm sure this will pass. And this is something just to put in our mind. So if you are going to be a board certified oral maxillofacial surgeon, and you will be providing office-based moderate, deep, or general anesthesia, you will have to have successfully completed an AMIS-approved anesthesia stimulation training course every 5 years. Members who provide office-based moderate, deep, general anesthesia provide verification their anesthesia assistants are certified by an AMIS-approved process. All members to attest that they are conducting quarterly teen mock emergency drills. And all members to complete an anesthesia survey every 5 years through the office evaluation program. So, you know, oral surgery is taking this just as seriously as the dental anesthesiology community, the CRNA community, and the ASA about, you know, how we improve anesthesia in this country. And I'm sure all of this is a national.
Oh.
This is national. So I know it's not in the statutes and things, but our bylaws will change in September. For oral surgeons, and all oral surgeons will be required to follow these things if they want to be board certified. So I think it's moving in the right direction.
This is Brady. Is that going through ABOMS then and not AMIS?
No, ABOMS is just our board process where you take the exam and you get boarded. But AMIS is the one who says that, okay, to be board certified, then you pass the board, ABOMS, and you also must fulfill these other criteria. You know, other things that we do is like you have to be an affiliate of a hospital. You can't be a board certified maxillofacial surgeon unless you have hospital privileges. You know, so it's more of a board certifications thing.
That was my question as to
enforcement.
I'm past president of our board, and so that's why I was wondering why it didn't stay with ABOMS within their renewal process.
Oh,
that's why it caught my attention.
I see.
Yeah, that's not for this committee. I'll talk to you later about that.
This is just
an interesting. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. Then let's move on. Agenda item number four, which is always on here, but I don't think we have much to talk about with the review of adverse occurrence reports.
We can take it. I think you guys just wanted it to always have reference to, but it doesn't have to be in here anymore.
I think it's good to keep it on. We can always choose to skip over it or talk about it, right? But if it's not on there, we can't talk about it?
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, we've discussed in the past of having this be kind of a standing committee, right? Could it be something that each meeting we talk about any new events that have come up since we did our review?
So, and that's actually evolved that this won't be a standing committee.
What will be
an investigative committee that I think we're still taking resumes for through
August 22nd.
August 20th. It's a Friday.
I didn't know that. Is there something sent out?
It was sent out because I think the board had decided that.
It's sent to all dentists.
Not dentists, but all licensees of the dental board.
It's an investigative committee beyond anesthesia, though.
I mean, oh, like for any complaint, help with the complaint. So non-dentists won't be on the.
Because they'll make recommendations.
But it's not a rulemaking committee. It's just there's a complaint against the licensee for filling a data root canal anesthesia
whatever, and then the committee will discuss and make a recommendation to the board. So it's not that the investigative committee is replacing the antiques committee at all. They're really separate. Ryan's just trying to confuse it.
That's what I do.
He's just breaking up with us. That's what so, yeah, I mean, regarding this agenda item, if there was an adverse occurrence that we wanted to discuss, we'd have to move to executive session anyway and know to have the charts set ahead of that, correct?
Yeah, it would have to be fully adjudicated by the board before it lands on the
So, in my opinion, it's not really worth keeping this on as a standing item because we can't really talk about the cases.
So this may be a point of clarification just to know. So if in going through the rules and it comes up, hey, I think we should propose this rule as we go through this, and someone says, well, no, because in the previous cases that we reviewed, all of a sudden I can't say that?
No, you can't. We're just talking about rulemaking. We just can't talk about, we're just not.
So it's just not the specifics of those cases?
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Blazek, I request we keep it on because I don't think we're done. And I would actually like to publish a study.
Okay.
And I'd like to have it come out from the state of Arizona that says this is what our research showed for the past 9 years or whatever it was. Dr. German and I, who were the ones who reviewed all the cases, we still felt there was a couple cases that were open. So I'd like to.
We have, need it.
Yeah.
We just because we take it off doesn't mean we can't put it back on.
Okay.
So I mean, if you guys want to leave it on.
This is Dr. Snell. I vote we leave it on. Just it's easier to say, do we want to do this and skip over it than it is to try to put it back on.
Any more discussion? Okay, summary of current events. Any committee members have any current events they want to talk about? We can move on. Let's jump back to call to the public. Do we have anybody signed in, Christina? No. Okay.
There are people there, though. Do you want to
know who's raising their hand or anything? Agenda item number 6, discussion of possible action items for future meeting agendas. So we talked about putting on you guys will meet first, and then we can potentially put on about legislative changes to the.
I think what we were saying is that Dr. Williams would make some suggestions with staff about how do we agendize the item, and that's what I would request. So before the next meeting, there is an agendized item that we discuss this idea about the permit or the grant, the surprise law or something.
They are working together on different boards.
Right.
Correct.
Yes, exactly. Let's make that agenda item for sure.
Yeah.
So we can do it. I think we're running out of time. And what I had mentioned during the meeting is you may want to start meeting with your own lobbyists.
Because we can do both. Yeah, we'll do both. Yeah.
Because this committee is not going to be, nothing will come out of this committee except for a recommendation to the board. So if we meet September 17th or whatever the next date is, the next meeting after that, sometime beginning of October, if there's a recommendation, then we can do that. So we can add it. I'll talk to Dr. Williams.
Can I get a point of clarification? The role of this committee is to make recommendations on rule changes.
Correct.
And that is not a recommendation we can make on rule changes, so we might as well just do it outside the committee.
I second that.
And on the plus side, we can do it over here.